The next case on today's calendar is State v. Inzunza, case number 75662. Hi, Mr. Polani, you ready to go?
If I may reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, of course.
Good morning, Justice Silver, Justice Hardesty, Justice Stiglitz. My name is Jake Polani. I represent appellant State of Nevada in this matter. First and foremost, regarding the facts of this particular case, I want to note up front that the state's position is that the criminal complaint that's being complained of here was dismissed. This case was indicted because it was well within the statute of limitations period, and a separate case was created at that time. The state feels this should be dispositive of that issue. We disagree that the statute of limitations shouldn't have any bearing on the prejudice analysis further regarding the Doggett analysis. The legislature makes calls as to what our community deems acceptable regarding prejudice to suspects versus justice served for victims. There's projects such as the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative that are currently running, federally funded projects that are aimed solely at looking back at these old cases and redoing investigations and finding suspects using better investigative methods. Nothing is said regarding Doggett to these cases. Many felonies in our jurisdiction carry a 3-year statute of limitations. Some carry a 4-year. Sexual assault and murder carry the longest statute of limitations periods in our jurisdiction. It's common that better investigations get done by better investigators and better investigative methods, more attention to detail. They're able to locate suspects where previous investigators fail. That's a common thing.
There was nothing extraordinary about trying to find this person. These are rudimentary. Look on Facebook, mom said, here's where he's living, mom said, here's where he's working. I mean, this isn't one of those situations, is it?
The problem there, Justice Stiglitz, is the manner in which a case and an investigation flows through the system. So Detective Hoyt, and I know, look, I have the utmost respect for Judge Ellsworth. I do respect her. I think she got it wrong in this instance, but she was no fan of his. However, he did a good investigation in this case, and it's shown by the fact that at the time of the disclosure, 2 separate suspects were actually named by this victim. She was touched separately by a man by the name of Darrington Rivers, and then Mr. Inzunza, his actions were also disclosed at the same time to the therapist. Detective Hoyt investigated both cases at the same time. Mr. Rivers was a local. He worked over at the airport. He was taken into custody immediately. He got a confession out of him. He pled guilty to attempt lewdness with a minor and is currently serving a sentence of, I believe it's 5 to 20 years in the Nevada Department of Corrections. Now, using the district court's analysis, all Mr. Rivers had to do was move to Florida and set up a Facebook page and survive for 2.5 years. And then his case would have been dismissed. The way the Facebook stuff came into play was late in his investigation, he was provided a copy of a Facebook page from the mother of the victim. That copy went into his file. At that time, there was no active warrant. He couldn't call authorities in that jurisdiction and say, arrest this person. He had not received a warrant. He submitted the case to our office. The way the North Las Vegas Police Department works is once the case is submitted, the detectives are not informed when we issue a warrant.
Well, isn't there something wrong then with their department? I mean, because when screening in the DA's office, when they approve a case, you get notification that your case has been approved, or you get a request further investigation, or you get a denial. The detectives informed and notice of what has gone on with their case. And if that's the case and it was approved, how is it that a detective doesn't go out and get the suspect?
I think we have a misunderstanding of how that actually works, Justice Silver. I don't believe that they get informed when a warrant is approved.
Now, okay, I was on screening for 3 years.
A number of years ago. I don't think
so. So you don't think that when they submit a case that they don't get notification that their case has been approved, request further, or denied?
That was the testimony. Now, I'm not saying request further. Now, Detective Hoyt did acknowledge if they request further, they definitely get that because they need the information from the officer. The way the North Las Vegas Police Department works, the detective isn't noticed. They have a data entry person that is noticed that then puts the warrant up into NCIC. The detective is not noticed until the arrest of that defendant.
But isn't that a problem with that particular department?
I think it's a function of the triage under which the North Las Vegas Police Department, and to a large extent, Metro is operating. So let's take that to its logical conclusion. Detective Hoyt is informed, hey, your warrant has been approved. He's now in that time frame. It could have been 2 days. It could have been 2 months since that warrant's been approved. He's picked up 5-10 more cases to add to his caseload he's already carrying, which he testified to, of 50 cases. So he's constantly trying to stay on top of his caseload. Is he to then stop and go try to fly to New Jersey to pick this guy up on his own, try to contact that case? They're constantly moving forward, which is why they rely so heavily on the National Crime Information Center. They put the warrant in there, and it worked as it should in this case. 26 months later, he makes a police contact. He's arrested.
But that's passive. It could have been 10 years later. I mean, is that the way? Do you think that passes constitutional muster to just charge somebody and just hope they show up? Don't you think they have to show efforts to bring that prosecution to conclusion?
I think it goes beyond just charging somebody and hoping they show up. I mean, any police conduct or any police contact, any sort of background check is run, you're on the system. You try to do any sort of travel, you're flagged there. The reason the NCIC is so heavily relied upon is because it's so effective.
Do you think that reliance is sufficient in and of itself? Once you throw the warrant in, you can pencils down, and we'll see if he tries to travel or get in the system. Do you think that is sufficient from a prosecutorial standpoint, constitutionally, to just once the warrant's in, your work is done?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. I mean, given the effectiveness of the NCIC system, I do. Now, look, it's not to show, you know, you can't say Detective Hoyt didn't do any investigation in this case, because look at Darrington Rivers. Darrington Rivers is serving time for his actual crime.
Yeah, but that's not his case. This is in Zunza.
No,
in
Zunza?
I think I'm saying that right.
I believe so.
I'm not sure. But okay.
The DA's office filed a complaint. I mean,
Right. Which was later dismissed. And that goes back to my first point is, look, we could have not filed a complaint. If that's the linchpin here, we could have not filed a complaint. Detective Hoyt could have come to us with this case even today. EJ is not 21 as of today. She had until, under the statute of limitations where she was, she had until 21 years of age to actually come forward with this case. Currently, the age is 38. The legislature is moving away from this and giving victims more time to recover from the trauma of these events.
But they're not giving police more time to do an investigation if it comes to them.
Well, what I'm saying is she could have waited for these charges. So what we're doing by effectively saying, well, by coming forward earlier, we're going to punish you because your mom did additional investigation. This has nothing to do with Detective Hoyt. The mom went out and found the Facebook page. So then we could take that out of the equation. What if mom hadn't done that for their investigation?
I don't think the principles espoused in Doggett are punishing the victims. Doggett is focused on what happens with the police investigation and the efforts that are made to secure the presence of the defendant and the arrest of the defendant. So I take exception to the suggestion that the constitutional principles here are intended to punish a victim. To your question, though, on the legal issue, it seems to me that the consideration of the statute of limitations in this context has been rejected by a number of other cases. What about that?
And I'm not saying it should be dispositive, Justice. What I'm saying...
No, should it even be considered? There are cases cited in this case and in this argument that it shouldn't be considered. And I'd like you to address that legal question.
Sure. Yeah. I do believe it should be considered to the extent to the whether or not the defendant was prejudiced by the delay. And that's where I was going with kind of my analysis before is she didn't have to disclose in 2014. She could have waited till 2020 to disclose. Then we're not dealing with this prejudicial analysis because the criminal complaint would have been filed
at
that point.
Let's go to the prejudice prong under Doggett.
Sure.
Doggett. Who has the burden with respect to that issue? The briefs are a little bit confusing here, and I think the case isn't. It seems as though once the district court judge has concluded that there's a presumptive prejudice, the burden shifts to the state to demonstrate that there has been no prejudice on the part of the defendant. And I don't see any issues raised in the district court that, for example, the witnesses are still available or potential defenses can still be had or that the defendant is deprived of some evidentiary position. None of that seems to be vetted. Am I wrong about that?
You're not wrong. I mean, to that point, I would note that the defendant did have a number of people. I remember 7-plus people waiting outside to testify at that evidentiary hearing.
Yeah.
And I believe that was mentioned on the record as well. But to your... is this my total time?
No, you have 5 minutes. I'll give you some additional time to answer this question. I have two questions, really. One, do you agree that the state has the burden when the court, if we agree, because of the period of time in excess of a year, has a presumptive prejudice, so the state has the burden? And if so, what did the state demonstrate in the court below with respect to the issue of the defendant's prejudice or lack thereof?
And I'll attempt to answer your second question by answering your first. No, I do not believe the burden shifted to us. I believe what happened is there was a little bit of muddiness regarding the difference between a finding of presumptive prejudicial delay and a finding that a suspect is presumed to have suffered prejudice in this case. The finding of presumptive prejudicial delay triggered the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that a suspect still has to show some sort of actual prejudice. The state can't rebut something that's not shown. There was never a claim made on the other side that, hey, I'm unable to call XYZ witness. The state has presented its case. The reports are all there. Everything was memorialized. However, we received no complaint as to, hey, I can't call this witness, I can't establish this alibi. There was no notice filed at all. Remember, we went through two and a half trial settings on this before this motion was even raised. We were ready to go twice. So I hope that answers your question, Justice Harsey.
Maybe some questioning of your colleagues will inspire some additional responses.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Westbrook?
Good morning, Justices. David Westbrook on behalf of Mr. Nzunza. That was the correct pronunciation. Thank you, Your Honor. I want to jump right into Justice Silver's question. Do you think there's a problem with that? This detective claims that he was not alerted or that he's not alerted as a matter of practice in his office when a warrant is issued. Whether that's true or not, nobody from North Las Vegas came in and said, that's our policy. He did, while he was up there doing a little bit of CYA. He says that it can take 5-6 months sometimes, or 5-6 weeks sometimes, and they're never alerted. But he also admitted that their records department is alerted, and he could be alerted. Furthermore, it only took 2 weeks in this case. 2 weeks after he submitted it, there was an arrest warrant issued. So he could have known who knows if he did know, but the information was there. He just didn't choose to follow it up. And when I asked him in the hearing, so this communication problem that you've got with your department, is everyone aware of it? And his response was, problem. Who's saying that it's a problem? Judge Ellsworth asked him about speedy trial rights. Specifically, were you trained on speedy trial rights? Do you recognize that by not pursuing these things in a timely fashion, that you are violating the speedy trial rights of the defendant? He answered yes to all of those questions. She found in her order that he acted with willful neglect. She found that it was gross negligence on part of the department, not just mere negligence, but gross negligence. You'll notice that in the opening brief, they kept the word gross out of every mention of negligence. They just said the judge's finding of negligence. Well, she found gross negligence, which is required to, more deference, her finding, more weight in the analysis. Okay. But honestly, I think she gave him a break on that. He was willful. He knew about the rights. He knew that he would violate them, and he did nothing. And as far as the other question about, I think it was Justice Stiglitz, couldn't he have just picked up a phone? The guy gets paid $250,000 a year in salary and benefits, and he couldn't dial a phone when he had the phone number? That takes 2 seconds. The docket court listed what the FBI did in their case, or the federal investigators did, and it was significantly more than Detective Hoyt did in this case. And I'm sorry, but he doesn't get credit for, in a completely different case that allegedly happened years later, getting a completely different suspect and having a case that eventually wound up in a guilty plea. Okay, Darrington Rivers is not Mr. Nzunza. Okay, Darrington Rivers is cited as a witness for the state in this case, but they are not the same case. They are two completely different cases. And that's very important, too, when we start talking about who is responsible for continuances in this case, but I'll get to that later. So he doesn't get credit for doing a good job in one case and doing a terrible job in the other case. We all have jobs to do, and those jobs are the same in every case. Sometimes you do a good job, and sometimes you do a bad job. But the good job doesn't forgive the bad job. It's irrelevant. What this case is about is abuse of discretion. We've all agreed on what the standard is on appeal, and it's abuse of discretion. And it was incumbent upon the state to actually prove that Judge Ellsworth abused her discretion. We all know she has it. It's stated in Barker. These kinds of factual analyses, these four steps, and how much weight to give each one of the steps of this test is entirely in the discretion of the court and can be only overturned if it is arbitrary or capricious. I look up the definition of arbitrary: baseless, despotic, capricious, a sudden turn of mind without apparent motive, a freak whim, a mere fancy. Judge Ellsworth applied the test, all four factors. And I take issue with the state's brief where they say that she ignored certain factors. She ignored nothing. Every time they say she ignored something, you can look at your brief and, at the brief and confirm this, that she ignored it, they point to a quote where she says, "I focused primarily on blank. I focused primarily on the time period between the initial criminal complaint and his arrest." When we focus primarily on something, it means we've considered everything, and then we focus primarily on it. Same reason why I wear glasses when I have to focus primarily on the paper in front of me, and I take them off when I'm talking to you. Focusing primarily on something is not the same thing as ignoring it. And as to her question about prejudice, the burden is on the state. That's very clear in Doggett. The burden is on the state. There's a burden as far as establishing whether we're in speedy trial land, as I like to call it, Sixth Amendment violation, or whether we can proceed with it. And then there's a burden involving demonstration of prejudice. Doggett recognized, and this was a big change in the law, and it's one that we've been following since 1992, they recognized that it's very difficult in situations like this to prove up prejudice for evidence that may have disappeared, for people's memories that may have changed or become unreliable over the years. Those things are very difficult to prove. And Doggett says that it was not the burden of Mr. Nzunza to prove them. It was the state's burden to address them. But when I was doing the argument, I put that all aside. I actually put up examples of actual prejudice that affected Mr. Nzunza. And so the state had the burden of proving that there was no prejudice. They failed that burden completely. And they didn't even attack the actual prejudice that I argued. In fact, Judge Ellsworth made a specific finding of fact that the state offered her nothing. And she asked multiple times and got no response. Again, we all have our jobs to do. We all have our jobs to do. And the state's job at the trial level was to present something to her, something that she could consider. And her finding was that nothing was presented. I was an appellate lawyer exclusively for 5 years. It's frustrating as an appellate lawyer when the trial lawyer doesn't make a good record. But this is basic trial stuff. You want to make an argument down below? You put it in your brief. You don't leave it out of your brief. You want to argue something with the court? You make sure you get your argument out. And if you don't, then you file an offer of proof so that there's a record on appeal. None of that happened at the trial level, which brings me to another point. We filed a motion to dismiss this reply brief. I found the reply brief, frankly, quite upsetting because I thought it was replete with mischaracterizations of the record, outright falsehoods. But it was also, which is illegal, or not illegal, it's against the rule under NRAF 28, it was also full of brand new arguments that were never presented below. Judge Ellsworth never got to consider them. We never got to respond to them in our answering brief. They were brand new. And we wrote a motion about that. I can address the reasons why the entire reply brief should be stricken, if the court wishes. But, you know, given the 7 minutes and 47 seconds left, I want to go where the court wants me to go. But the fact is, and you know, Mr. Van Bosburg wrote the brief, and he's made these kinds of motions before to strike reply briefs. He referred to that kind of action of creating new arguments in the reply brief as skullduggery. This kind of skullduggery must not be allowed. Well, I completely agree. I completely agree. Because when I read that reply brief, I thought, where were these arguments below? Where was my chance to respond? So these arguments concerning the third factor of the test, whether or not my client invoked his right to a speedy trial, the period after arrest, the prejudice ratio, none of these things were raised below. The statute of limitations argument, which I think the court recognizes, is completely wrong. I think the problem here is the state doesn't understand the difference between the Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment. All of the stuff that happens under statute of limitations prior to a charging document, that's all due process stuff. And the statute of limitations controls due process. But once the charging document has been filed, now we're talking about the Sixth Amendment, which is the reason why the state, even with all of their new arguments they made in their reply brief, was unable to produce a single case where a Sixth Amendment claim was overturned based on a Fifth Amendment case. Not one case. Even their reaction to our Ohio case that was cited, they tried to use a Fifth Amendment case, all of which happened before a charging document was filed, and pretend that it applies to the Sixth Amendment somehow. It simply does not, and I think the court recognizes that. I do want to talk a little bit about Mr. Nzunza invoking his speedy trial rights, because I find this really upsetting. If you look at the reply brief between pages 15, the bottom of page 15 and the top of 16, I counted eight misrepresentations of fact or law in one paragraph. Eight of them. It's a remarkable run. A lot of them had to do with the following. They keep saying, in arguing about what happened after Mr. Nzunza's arrest, that the defense is responsible for continuances. What they're forgetting is the following. My very first appearance in court with Mr. Nzunza actually happened in district court as arraignment, because they went to the grand jury. So I had no other appearance in court with him beforehand, which means that that was the absolute first time that he could invoke a speedy trial. Judge Ellsworth specifically noted in her order on page 2 that I specifically said that we would be waiting 60 days. I had no discovery. There's no way I could do a 60-day rule, not on a 35-year-to-life case. Okay? We were waiting 60 days, but we are specifically invoking our right to a speedy trial. For them to come in multiple times and saying that the right to a speedy trial was never invoked, particularly since that argument was never made down below, and the state has admitted that speedy trial was invoked, is ridiculous. How can they say that? They also said that I was responsible for two continuances, when the record shows I never asked for a continuance. What I asked is for the court to not make my client choose between a speedy trial and a fair trial. That kind of opt-in choice is illegal under the Constitution of the United States of America and the Nevada Constitution. And I was in a position with Mr. Nzunza where it seemed like I was being forced to choose. The actual record states, and it's all in the appendix, that at the first continuance, the state had failed to turn over certain evidence, and I was forced to put on a motion to compel. I'd been asking for evidence for weeks. It hadn't been turned over. I wasn't even getting direct responses about what evidence had been explored, whether the state had talked to the detective and looked at his file. I was literally told, I don't answer to you when I ask those questions. Okay? So I had to put on a motion to compel. Calendar call was continued from the 27th to the 29th, and on the 28th, lo and behold, there was a brand new video of an interview that was in Spanish that had never been turned over. So after representing that the state was ready to go at the first calendar call date, it turned out they weren't ready to go because there was brand new evidence that had never been turned over that was turned over the next day, the day after calendar call. Judge Ellsworth specifically continued the case because of that violation of the NRS 174 30-day rule. How can that be contributed to Mr. Nzunza? How can it possibly be said with a straight face that Mr. Nzunza didn't want a speedy trial when I invoked speedy trial and I said, this is not our continuance, we can't go because the state hasn't done its job? And you can't dispute the fact that they turned over an important video the day after calendar call. That is not a defense continuance, and it certainly isn't a waiver. At the second continuance, much the same thing happened. The state was talking about the Darrington Rivers case. I had asked for the Darrington Rivers file because they noted him as a witness. Now, his case took place years later. I don't know what his relevance is even today. But I asked for his file, and I was told, well, he doesn't have a different file. And I thought, how could that possibly be the case? And then when we went to calendar call, I said, I need the Staring River file. They won't turn it over. And ultimately, the court said, well, it was my continuance. Again, when the state doesn't do its job and doesn't produce discovery, it's not our continuance. And I specifically said, again, they say that I waived it and I asked for continuance to consult with an expert, which is just not true. It says right in the minutes, this is where you need the glasses to focus, Mr. Westbrook stated he was not waiving the defendant's right to a speedy trial, and he did not file a motion to continue, as he did not want it to seem like it was his motion to continue. I don't know how to be clearer in invoking speedy trial and saying that this is not my request for a continuance. I also, after Mr. Vellani made his representations, we had an evidentiary hearing with Detective Hoyt. One of the many questions I asked Detective Hoyt was the following, because I wanted to determine whether or not this Rivers files actually existed. You said you investigated Darrington Rivers at the same time, right? Detective Hoyt says, yes, give or take weeks or months. Again, there was a separation in the investigation. Okay, and that case would be under a separate event number because it was a different defendant, right? Hoyt, correct. There would be a separate file for that case, isn't that right? Hoyt, yes. There's a Darrington Rivers file out there. I requested it numerous times. I put on motions to compel. It's never been turned over. That is not a defense continuance. And so when Mr. Van Boskirk says that I waived speedy trial numerous times, it's just not true. And given the number, the sheer number of misrepresentations in the record, I think the court should find that disconcerting. I certainly found it disconcerting.
Mr. Westbrook, I'd like to circle back to where Mr. Vellani began and ask you to address the legal import, if any, of the fact that the state is pursuing your client based upon an indictment rather than the criminal complaint filed 3 years before.
It's a brand new argument, completely. It shouldn't be addressed by this court under NRAP. However, I can certainly address it. It's the same case, same victim, the same exact charges. If they are allowed to abuse the grand jury system in order to make up for a deprivation of a right that cannot be cured by any remedy other than dismissal, and the case law is very clear on that, the only remedy for a violation of speedy trial is a dismissal, because we don't have time machines. Okay? In order, it's using the grand jury system in order to try to cure some kind of violation of a Sixth Amendment right is not allowable. It's certainly not just, and they shouldn't even be thinking of that kind of an argument. And there's no case law to support it. In fact, there are other cases that have been cited where the state ultimately went to the grand jury, and the case was never dismissed just because someone changed the number at the top. This would be such a gateway to abusing the rights of defendants that it doesn't even bear thinking about. And there's no support for it. There's no support. You've got to cite cases. You know, again, this is basic trial stuff. It's a bad record below, and you can't cure it with new arguments up top. You've got to go with the record below. It's frustrating as an appellate attorney, but sometimes you're stuck with a bad record. This is a bad record.
Thank you, Mr. Westbrook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to shy away really from addressing anything post-arrest because Judge Ellsworth's order was pretty specific as to the time frame she was considering being issuance of the criminal complaint to arrest. But I do want to clear up one thing for the record. There were no Spanish speakers here. That video turned over was a video of a CAC interview of which Mr. Westbrook already had the audio. The reason for the continuance stated on the record was he wanted to have an expert review it. So short of that, I'm not going to address...
It was a what interview?
I'm sorry, Children's Assessment Center. So there's a camera that they bring him down when...
So it's the victim statement.
Victim statement, yeah. Forensic interview of the victim.
Mr. Vellani, yes. Is Mr. Westbrook correct that the argument you started with today... that there is some legal significance to the fact that the state is pursuing the charges against Mr. Nzunza under an indictment rather than the complaint. Was that presented to Judge Ellsworth below?
In every single pleading we've done in this case, it's been noted that a criminal complaint was initially filed, dismissed.
That's not my question. Did you assert as an argument in the Doggett and Barker analysis that the court should consider that difference?
I don't believe I did below, Your Honor.
All right.
However, if I may, it is mentioned in Judge Ellsworth's order, that fact that this criminal complaint was dismissed, we presented an indictment instead. The district court did abuse its discretion here, Justices. We disagree with the finding that the state was solely responsible for the delay here. Mr. Nzunza moved to New Jersey, fled to New Jersey. That's what's responsible
for
it.
Well, what's the evidence that he fled? Fled having some connotations.
Well, I think the evidence is in the surrounding circumstances. Our allegations that he was sexually molesting a young lady for a number of years. As soon as he moves out of that house, he moves across the country. Now, I know he's got a Facebook page, and it's not like he's living open and notorious, and I don't, quite frankly, have enough investigation under me to know the extent to which he was living there. But that's the surrounding circumstances what I'm basing his flight on, Justice Stiglitz. We disagree that Detective Hoyt was grossly negligent in not following up on the Facebook page. That's all that was done. He was provided a piece of paper by the mom here that wasn't followed up on. That's considered grossly negligent. Even in the Doggett case, the 8 years, bouncing back and forth, contact with numerous people, that was found to be negligent.
So I'd like to return to the legal standard here.
Sure.
If the standard is abuse of discretion and if deference on fact-finding is given to the trial judge, how do we reverse that determination? What about that determination was an abuse of discretion?
Well, I think the fact you have the transcript of the hearing.
It seems like you're asking us, though, to second guess the district court's assessment of the witness who testified, the witnesses, the inferences, and the facts that she drew from that hearing.
I'm asking you to second-guess them only to the extent that it was an abuse of discretion to find him grossly negligent. I think you have the record in front of you that you can make that.
So would you agree then that he was at least negligent?
I would agree that there's negligence there in not following up on that.
So if we were to write a disposition in which we found the difference between negligence and gross negligence to exist, how would we write that in this case? We're writing a disposition. Now I'm saying, Mr. Bellani, you're writing the disposition. Advise the court on how we would articulate that against this record and against the judge's finding.
And I see I'm out of time. May I proceed?
You can answer the question.
All right. Thank you. The difference between negligence and gross negligence is, look, negligence is overlooking. We all make mistakes as we go throughout our days. Mm-hmm. Gross negligence, there has to be some form of purposeful misconduct there. And I know there is a separate standard then for an intentional misconduct. But there has to be some sort of purposeful blinding that then benefits the doer. Right? So that's how I would make the distinction. Negligence, we make mistakes. Gross negligence, you made a mistake, but it really benefited you, so we can make that determination that you might have made that mistake just for your benefit. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Bellani.